And as they said, that was the observer who was missing in quantum theory without observers. And of course, if he had been here, the hope, he wouldn't have been an observer, right? That he would have been talking to us. And when I think back to that meeting, and I think just about the time from then until now, I feel like my basic understanding of these problems has shifted and has clarified, and that essentially with all kinds of help from Shelley and Detlef and Nino and David and Giancarlo and a lot of other people in this room, but somehow, whenever I think, finally, now I've got it clear, I realize, yeah, Bell already said it, and I wasn't paying attention. So more or less, what I'm just going to try to do is stand in as well as I can with lots of quotes for what Bell was up to, which I think gives us a slightly different picture, or we'll see at the end, I'm going to come to David's ideas at the end, and they'll look a little different. So let me just talk about Bell's project. This quote is, of course, we'll come back to it, but gives us the basic idea. So a preliminary account of these notions, this is from Beables for Quantum Field Theory, was entitled Quantum Field Theory Without Observers or Observables or Measurements or Systems or Apparatus or Wave Function Collapse or anything like that, right? This could suggest to some that the issue in question is a philosophical one, and I really appreciate this part of the quote as a philosopher, because philosophical is used as a term of abuse most of the places that I give talks like this. But I insist my concern is strictly professional. I think that conventional formulations of quantum theory and of quantum field theory in particular are unprofessionally vague and ambiguous. Professional theoretical physicists ought to be able to do better. And I take it that's the project that we're all engaged in. The next sentence is interesting, and I wanted to put it off separately because I want to make... The next sentence is, Bohm has shown us a way. Now, I think this is why there's a lot of talk about Bohmian mechanics, but notice that Bell just says a way, not the way. And I think Bell showed us a way which can be characterized in rather broad terms, broader than maybe most of us realized at the beginning, broad enough terms to encompass within it a lot of different projects that we thought maybe the first time this meeting occurred were fundamentally different projects. Just to go back for a second, as we'll see at the end, on this funny list, on this important list, of things you should do without, one is wave function collapse, and we'll see at the end, wave function collapse, that's going to be okay. That one doesn't have to come off the list, as long as it's something that's clearly in the equations, as Bell would say, and not in the talk. All right. So, what is it we're trying to accomplish here? Well, the main thing we want to have understood, I think, is the connection between any physical theory and data, because after all, physics is supposed to be an empirical discipline. There has to be some data, there has to be something that comes in that tells us whether our theory is on the right or wrong track. So let's just take it, and this I think David will agree with, that a complete physical theory, as opposed to what? Well, an effective practical tool for making predictions, for example. Someone might give me that, and it might be effective for all practical purposes, but not be a complete physical theory in the sense I'm about to describe. A complete physical theory should contain within it a physical account of the facts that are taken to constitute the data against which the theory is tested. Okay? In a way, the whole measurement problem is in that sentence, although I didn't use the word measurement. You could have an effective device for calculating predictions, but not treat it as a serious proposal for a physical theory, and in fact, you could have such an effective device for making prediction, and it not even be presented in the right form that you could take it seriously as a proposal for a complete physical theory. And part of what we're trying to get clear about is what that form is. Now, if we ask, how did we get into the mess we're in, and we go back to the beginning To the original sin, we of course find it with Bohr. Bohr did talk about this, the connection between theory and data. It's not that he ignored it, it's what he said about it that was the problem. So, Bohr, and I know there are lots of things people call the Copenhagen interpretation, there is no one thing, but I just want to go through some quotes of Bohr and see what he actually did say. And you'll see, on the data side, Bohr insisted, right, that the data of the theory, which is typically going to have to do with the description of laboratory operations and results, be described in what he called classical language. And these are now quotes from the Schilp volume on Einstein. So this is late 49, late in Bohr's career, things he presumably thought after all those years were still correct. Here's something he said which was good. All of this is actually a continuous quotation. For this purpose, it's decisive to recognize that however far the phenomena transcend the scope of classical physical explanation, the account of all evidence, right, data, must be expressed in classical terms. The argument for this is simply that the word experiment, by the word experiment, we refer to a situation where we can tell others what we've done and what we've learned, and that therefore the account of the experimental arrangement out of the results of the observations must be expressed in unambiguous language with suitable application of the terminology of classical physics. Well, at least it gets a little bit worse. This, as you'll see, this just goes downhill. It's getting a little bit bad by the bottom. Let's go on to the next part of the quote, which starts to get us into a lot of trouble. As stressed, and he's talking about the Como lecture, an adequate tool for a complementary way of description is offered precisely by the quantum mechanical formalism, which represents a purely symbolic scheme. Notice, purely symbolic scheme already sort of suggests to you, you can't take this seriously as a proposal for a physical account of things, right? Why is he calling it purely symbolic? Purely symbolic scheme permitting only predictions on the lines of the correspondence principle as to results obtainable under conditions specified by means of classical concepts. It must be remembered that even in the indeterminacy relation, which is what he called what we normally call now the uncertainty relation, we're dealing with an implication of the formalism which defies unambiguous expression in words suited to describe classical physical pictures. So already somehow words fail you when you start to get to quantum mechanics. And then his example, thus a sentence like we cannot know both the momentum and position of an atomic object raises at once questions as to the physical reality of two such attributes of the object, which can be answered only by referring to conditions for the unambiguous use of space-time concepts on the one hand and dynamical conservation laws on the other. So his idea is, if you even ask about the position in space-time of a particle, there must be a certain kind of classical laboratory setup that you're referring to for your words to mean anything. And if you want to talk, say anything about the momentum or energy, which he thinks of as giving the causal description of things of a particle or of a system, it must be in the condition of a different kind of laboratory setup. And those two laboratory setups are incompatible with one another. You just can't set them both up at the same time. And that's going to be the source of complementarity. Okay? While the combination of these concepts into a single picture of a causal chain of events is the essence of classical mechanics, room for regularities beyond the grasp of such a description is afforded by the circumstance that the study of complementarity phenomena demands mutually exclusive experimental arrangements. So if you can't set up the two experimental arrangements at the same time, you can't simultaneously give a space-time description and a causal description, and it is the essence of classical theory, classical mechanics, to have both of those pieces, which is why we use a classical phase space, and we have to specify both the positions and the moment of the particle in order to get the whole thing to run. Oh, okay, sorry. I'll try and slow down. Why is the bad part so bad? All right, so he says that concepts such as the space-time trajectory or the energy, or energy and causation, this other set of concepts, can only be applied to quantum systems in certain classically described circumstances, right? So the idea is if you want to say a quantum particle has a position, That will only make sense if it's there's the right kind of classical environment. That implies that the classically described circumstances that allow you to say these things, okay, themselves can't be the consequences of a quantum mechanical description, right? Because the quantum mechanically, to ascribe a position to anything requires the right kind of environment. How does the environment get its description? Okay? It's this that yields the measurement, I claim, the measurement problem in its most virulent form. That is, on Bohr's picture, you can't give a quantum mechanical account of the entire experimental apparatus. Right? There has to be a classical part. To work our way out of this, okay, we need for there to be some features that just obtain independently of their environment. So if to talk about the position of a particle requires a certain environment, to talk about the momentum of a particle requires a different kind of environment, there has to be something that doesn't require an environment. I mean, eventually you run out of environments. Those features that just obtain independently of their environment constitute the experimental arrangements that in turn may play a role in defining some of the properties of the quantum system. Now notice, in this talk in Bohr, the word classical is used in two very different senses. And I think one of the confusions that lingers on is not carefully separating these two senses. One sense is tied to classical dynamics. So where you have to specify the positions and momenta of all the fundamental objects in order to run the dynamics, okay? Which Bohr talks about giving the space-time description on the one hand in terms of positions and the causal description on the other in terms of momentum and energy, okay? And Bohr says, well, quantum systems can't be classical in that sense because quantum objects can't have both positions and momenta at the same time. But there's another sense of classical that's used here. Remember how Bohr started? He said, the experimental arrangements have to be described using a classical language. Why? Because we have to be able to tell people what we did and have them understand it and communicate it. Right? What did I do in the laboratory? Notice that sense of classical not only does not, but it cannot require that the experimental apparatus obeys classical dynamics, right? If the experimental apparatus had to be classical in the sense of obeying classical dynamics, then we would explain classically whatever result we got from the experiment, right? Just analyze the apparatus and apply classical dynamics to it. It'll tell you which way the pointer is going to go. So there's one sense in which the apparatus has to be classical, but it can't be that sense. So what did he say? He said, well, the environment or the laboratory has to be described classically in the sense of being communicable in unambiguous language. You saw that first quote. Now, if you think about that first quote, it's a little hard to even understand what he had in mind. He said, well, you have to describe things classically because you want to be able to communicate to other people what happened. And you're not quite sure what he was ruling out there. I mean, is somebody supposed to go into a laboratory, do an experiment, and when they come out and try and describe to you what their experiment was, they just don't have words for it? They thought, I just really don't even, he said this is sort of the source of this demand for classicality. It's very hard to understand what that was supposed to be, right? So obviously, if you describe what happens in a laboratory, you better describe it in a way comprehensible in natural language. That's a very weak constraint. The more difficult and important requirement is that the language of the data should be, in a complete physical theory, unambiguously connected to the description given by the theory, right? That's where the unambiguous connection and clear connection ought to be. It's only in that way that you can derive from the theoretical description the data in a principled way. Now that might seem a little vague, so now we're just going to try and get concrete about it in the way that I think Bell wanted us to. So here's the way Bell articulates it. So he introduced the term beables, which you can have a long debate whether it was a good term and so on, but let's just take it for now. And what he meant was physical elements in a system that are simply there, right, that just exist without having to mention the environment or anything being done to them or anything else. So the quote, in particular, will exclude the notion of observable in favor of that of beable. The beables of a theory are those elements which might correspond to elements of reality, to things which exist. Their existence does not depend on observation. Indeed, observation and observers must be made out of beables, right? So there's, and you'll see, he says over and over again something like this sentence, and this sentence I take to be the essence of Bell's understanding of what it is to solve the measurement problem, right? To specify a physics that says there are certain things, and from those things you make observers and experiments and experimental conditions and so on. So, we can compare to Bohr here. The beables, right, obviously would end this regress problem we had with Bohr if some properties that a quantum system has depend on the environmental conditions, then at least some environmental conditions must hold of their own accord. Those things that are just there will be the beables in Bell's sense, and if the environment is describable in the language of quantum theory, which we think it should be because we think the environment is, after all, a quantum mechanical object, because we think the entire universe is a quantum mechanical object, then there must be some beables in quantum systems, which is the triviality of saying there has to be something that's just there. Now, Bell goes on and distinguishes among the beables the local beables. And so here's the quote. These are the mathematical counterparts in the theory to real events at definite places and times in the real world, as distinct from the many purely mathematical constructions that occur in the working out of physical theories, as distinct from things that may be real but not localized. We'll come back to this, that there can be beables that are not local, right? That are real, they're there. You take them as seriously as you take anything, but they are not localized. And as distinct from the, quote, observables of other formulations of quantum mechanics for which we have no use here. Local beables connect the theory to the data. So here's what I think is the central point of Bell's program. The concept of observable lends itself to very precise mathematics when identified with self-adjoint operator, but physically it's a rather woolly concept. Again, this is not a philosophically woolly, it's physically woolly. It's not easy to identify precisely which physical processes are to be given the status of observations and which are to be relegated to the limbo between one observation and another. So it could be hoped that some increase in precision might be possible by concentration on the beables, which can be described in, quote, classical terms because they are there. Notice, not in classical terms because they simultaneously have a space-time and causal, or they always have a momentum and so on. In classical terms, in the sense, just because they're there, they exist. The beables must include the settings of switches and knobs on experimental equipment, the currents in coils, and the readings of instruments. And this would be according to Bohr, right? Bohr would agree. Those are the sorts of things that you just have to be given in a classical language. Observables must be made, and once again, this almost the same sentence shows how important he thought it was. Observables must be made somehow out of beables. The theory of local beables should contain and give precise physical meaning to the algebra of local observables. So the mathematics gains physical significance via the local beables. Let's compare to Bohr again. As I said, Bell's use of classical has nothing to do with classical dynamics. The classical terms allow one to describe the experimental conditions at macroscopic scale, knobs and so on, in terms of the disposition of objects in space and time. And Bell's point is that the data and the description of experimental conditions is always given in terms of local beables at macroscopic scale, like the pointer moved this way rather than that way, right? That's saying what something that's just there did in space and time. If this is to be connected in a principled way, as opposed to by just some stipulation or some rule, but in a principled physical way to the language of the theory, to the physical theory, then the theory must have some local beables from which macroscopic objects are composed. Now, when I say he notes this, it's not anything he even says. It's so obvious, right? There's a simple, transparent, and comprehensible, and these words are important to me. This is why I think these are ways of understanding quantum mechanics we can really understand. There's a simple, transparent, comprehensible way for macroscopic objects to have locations in space-time at macroscopic scale. Namely, you postulate they're composed of local beables at microscopic scale. The bizarre position defended by Bohr seems to be that there must be macroscopic localized objects in a familiar space-time, right? There have to be, because that's how you report the results of your experiments, but they can't be composed of microscopic localized points described by parts described by quantum theory. Because the microscopic parts don't have... Okay, but the question is, if a table and a chair has a well-defined macroscopic location, but it's made up of electrons and particles and so on, none of which do, except if they're in some larger environment that defines them having a space-time location, which is just what he says, okay? You can't make something with a space-time location out of parts that don't have one. So, Bell explicates Bohr's theory in terms of a dual ontology. I'm just going to get to Bell's, macroscopic classical objects that define the experimental condition and a quantum world that is associated with a symbolic wave function. And the significance of the wave function is then exhausted by its role in calculating predictions for the behavior of the classical objects. The quantum system can never be described by both a space-time and causal vocabulary, but each individually may be appropriate in experimental conditions. That's Bohr, and here's what Bell has to say. So this is, again, a long quote, but I think an extremely important one. The kinematics of the world in this orthodox picture is given by a wave function, maybe more than one, who knows, for the quantum part, and classical variables, variables which have values and are therefore beables, right, for the classical part. Psi of t and q and so on, capital X of t. I hadn't even noticed until I wrote this down, that here it's a capital X, because those are macroscopic positions of things. I mean, Bell, again, he doesn't know to tell you this, but he's being very careful. The capital X means positions of macroscopic objects. The X's are somehow macroscopic. This is not spelled out very explicitly. The dynamics is not very precisely formulated either. Again, all the complaints are not, as it were, philosophical, but those of a professional physicist. It includes a Schrodinger equation for the quantum part and some sort of classical dynamics for the classical part and collapse recipes for their interaction. It seems to me that the only hope of precision with the dual psi, now little x, dynamics, kinematics, is to omit completely the shifty split between the classical and quantum and let both psi and the x refer to the world as a whole. Then the x's must not be confined to some vague macroscopic scale, but must extend to all scales. In the picture of de Broglie and Bohm, every particle is attributed a position, x of t. Then instrument pointers, assemblies of particles have positions, and experiments have results, right? So this is just the Bohrian classical language of instrument pointers is now a straightforward consequence of the fundamental quantum description at microscopic scale. The dynamics is given by the world Schrodinger equation, right? The universal wave function, that's the only one you need and the only one there really is, plus precise guiding equations. This is, of course, in Bohm's theory, prescribing how the x of t's move under the influence of psi. Particles are not attributed angular momentum, energies, etc. So unlike Bohr, who says at least in some circumstances, as it were, particles have energies and momenta in some fundamental way, for Bell, they sort of never do. But only positions as functions of time. But they always have positions, right? Peculiar, quote, measurement results for angular momenta, energy, and so on emerge as pointer positions in appropriate experimental setups. So this, again, was Bell's point. Somewhere else he says, if you make postulates, axioms rather than theorems and definitions about the measurement of anything other than position, you commit redundancy and risk inconsistency. Because at the end of the day, the outcomes of something you call an energy measurement or a momentum measurement, the outcomes will be recorded in positions of things. And if you get all those positions right, then you're going to get all the data right. So, mission accomplished, right? If all this works, then you get from the description of the physical world offered by the theory to the description of the data provided by the experiment without any mention anywhere of observers, observable systems, apparatuses, measurements, or anything like that. The work of making that connection is done by local beables that are postulated to constitute the macroscopic objects. The dynamics, including, and the dynamics may include non-local beables or other things, is going to be provided by the physical theory, and you get from microscopic to macroscopic the only way you can, by coarse graining. Now, what could the, according to this, you need some local beables. But there are lots of possibilities. So the question, how constrained is this? Is this somehow built to only fit, say, Bohmian mechanics? No, lots of things you could use, lots of things people have talked about. They've thought about particles. They've thought about continuous matter densities in space-time. Those are good local beables. They've thought about the flash ontology, point set in space-time. Those are good local beables. Bell talked about fermion number density in the context of doing field theory. You could clearly imagine someone doing this with, say, a string theory, where the fundamental objects are one-dimensional objects, and so on. All perfectly good possibilities for local beables. Well, local in what? Bell talks a lot about locality, and that means that the thing simply exists in a delimited region of space-time. Well, what kind of space-time? He doesn't talk a lot about that, but if we think about the methodology, we'll see there's some constraints on the kind of space-time if we want things to work this way. And the constraint is basically that we want to derive the language of the data from the description in the language of the theory by coarse graining. And this contrast with what David was saying should start to loom into view. Just by coarse graining, if we want to do it that way, then the theoretical description of the local beables and the space-time should, in the right circumstances, coarse grain to a familiar everyday description at macroscopic scale. In the right circumstances, of course, we only need this to happen if we're in a region of space-time that, like, we have laboratories in. So here are some proposals. Like, I gave you a list of proposals about possible local beables. Here are some space-times that would work perfectly well, some really tame ones, a sort of Newtonian absolute space and time, a neo-Newtonian space-time, a Newton-Cartan space-time, a Minkowski space-time, a globally hyperbolic solution to the Einstein field equations on a four-dimensional manifold. All of those will coarse-grain out at local scale macroscopically to recognizable laboratories. Okay. There are some surprising things you might think of, but still, the coarse graining will work just as easily and straightforwardly for them. If you wanted solutions to the field equations with closed time-like curves or other, you know, other sort of strange things that can happen in general relativity, typically that'll be okay. If you're doing string theory and you want to tell me there are a bunch of compactified dimensions in a Calabi-Yau space, that's going to be okay. That'll coarse grain right out because they're compactified, right? Once you get up to macroscopic scale, you don't notice that they're there. And you get a distribution of local objects in what is, for all intents and purposes, to within epsilon, a four-dimensional space-time, familiar four-dimensional space-time. So take that list of possible local beables and cross-check it with this list of possible acceptable space-times. You get a lot of different kinds of theories that you could investigate under this very general rubric. Here's a proposal about space-time structure that's floating around that's rather hard to understand. I'm not going to say anything about it, but I'm just putting it up here because it's one of the things that people talk about nowadays, the holographic principle that says somehow space-time is really just the boundary space and that there's a mass space or the middle space is an illusion. Right, that somehow, because there's a one-to-one correspondence between degrees of freedom on the boundary of some space and degrees of freedom in the interior, that you can really regard the real space in some sense, I don't know what that means, as just the boundary. I take it the reason it's called holography is that a hologram really is something that, honest to God, physically is only two-dimensional, but just manages to appear being three-dimensional. David, of course, was talking about something that was really, honest to God, very, very high dimension and somehow managed to appear three-dimensional, so another kind of strange appearance, misleading appearance surface appearance of space-time. Well, we'll get to that. Then there are some seriously weird suggestions. David just nicely gave us one. That the fundamental physical space, at least in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, is geometrically isomorphic to a classical configuration space. So it's a fundamental physical space of very, 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 very high dimensionality, and furthermore, not with all but four of the dimensions compactified, right? So it doesn't coarse grain out to what we want. Or this is just a quote from Sean Carroll. I don't even know quite what he had in mind, but he said it, so I put it up here. We live in Hilbert space, right? This is a little bit different because, of course, the configuration space isn't Hilbert space, but it's also a very high dimensional space, and it's a little bit hard to know how I'm waving my hand around in Hilbert space right now. Why these strange suggestions? Why David's? How did those come up? So the last two are unlike the first seven, all of which coarse grain at macroscopic scale in the right way. Again, leave aside the holographic principle. Why did they come up with that? Well, obviously, the thing that suggested them is the wave function, right? So you say, I want to somehow take the wave function seriously. This is what, and we'll have the quotes in a second. This is the way David begins. He says, I want to be a realist about quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics uses a wave function, so I need to really be a realist about the wave function. What does that commit me to? And you say, well, mathematically, the wave function is some square integral function that is defined on a high-dimensional space, and it lives in another kind of high-dimensional space. So if I want to take it really seriously, I have to take those spaces really seriously as fundamental. And the question is this really tenable, these radical positions? Notice that they begin with the wave function. I haven't really mentioned a wave function yet, right? And you retrofit, you sort of focus on that thing, and you retrofit an account of the fundamental structure of physical space or space-time by staring hard at the wave function. And what I want to argue is that that strategy is really, the way we got into that is exactly, it's a bad hangover from the historical avoidance of the measurement problem. After all, if you're avoiding the measurement problem, one thing you have that you can think about are wave functions. Those are being used by everybody, and they use them without worrying about the measurement problem. So David nicely reminded us of what he said in elementary quantum metaphysics. And I have the quotes, but you just heard them, so I can go through quickly, more or less the same. It's been essential, he says, that is, to the project of quantum mechanical realism to learn to think of wave functions as physical objects in and of themselves. And of course, the space those sorts of objects live in, the space which any realistic understanding of quantum mechanics is necessarily going to depict the history of the world as playing itself out, if space is the right name for it, of which may later, is configuration space. And whatever impression we have to the contrary, whatever impression we have, say, of living in a three-dimensional space or a four-dimensional space-time, is somehow flatly illusory. The sorts of physical objects that wave functions are, on this way of thinking, are plainly fields, which is to say they're the sorts of objects whose state one specifies by specifying the values of some set of numbers at every point in a space where they live. So the idea here, so to be realist about the wave function, I have to be realist about the space in which this thing lives, which is this high-dimensional space. And the sorts of objects whose states one specifies in this case by specifying the values of two numbers at every point in the universe's so-called configuration space. Now, what is Bell's approach? I mean, I went through all of Bell's approach, and I didn't really say much of anything about the quantum state or the wave function. What if we start with Bell's approach? How do we then understand the quantum state? Well, we get an entirely different picture of it, and a picture of its role. I know David doesn't like the word role, but I think it'll be clear here, its role in the theory, and a different understanding from the one David has about the significance of the mathematical object that we use to represent the quantum state being defined over this high-dimensional space. So let's just see how that goes. What is the empirical content of a quantum state? Why, if we introduce a quantum state into a physical theory, it must be for empirical reasons, because it, it somehow is going to help us to explain stuff we see. Now, if we agree that the data of the theory are a function of the distribution of some local beables via coarse graining, then the quantum state has empirical consequences only insofar as it helps determine the behavior of the local beables, right? If it didn't do anything, if it existed but had no influence on them, it would have no observable influence, and therefore we could have no empirical reason to believe in it. That is, the quantum state manifests itself in the data exactly to the extent that it influences the configuration of local beables. And that's going to be true. Suppose you think that something exists. So Bell says, among the beables of the theory, some are local, but there may be some that are not local. There may be some that you can't think of as just existing in some small region of space-time. For any such thing, you ask, well, why would we think there is such a thing? Only because it has some effect on the distribution of the local beables, right? And that would affect the data. And therefore, the mathematical form, now we're asking the question, what is a reasonable guess for the mathematical form of a representation of a non-local object where the empirical evidence we have for its existence is only through its effect on the configuration of local beables? Well, the mathematical form of the representative of the quantum state must be some mathematical kind to generate by some equation or other, right? I'm being very vague here, but you get the idea, a specification of how configurations of local beables will or might change, right? The equations somehow have to connect this object, my mathematical representation of this object, to the behavior of the local beables. An obvious mathematical object that can play this role is a function on configuration space. In the Bohmian case, by the obvious method of producing a velocity field, but there are other ways to do it. But the fact that configuration space should show up in the mathematical representation of this thing now is no longer a red light indication that if I take it seriously, I have to take the high-dimensional space seriously as fundamental. It really is a configuration space, right? In this picture, and therefore an abstract space, not a real physical space. So if we're going to do this, it's essential that we have a configuration space of what? Of a system with local beables in some space-time of the form 1 through 7 or something that coarse grains, you know, to space-time the way we think it is, at least now, in the present state of the universe. So again, if someone wants to say, look, I'm doing quantum cosmology, and I don't want to be stuck with the idea that space-time has to coarse-grain to a four-dimensional manifold in general. Well, you're not stuck with that. If you want to say back before the Big Bang or in other sectors or whatever, it has some completely different form, fine. Because what are we trying to do? We're trying to recover the data, and the data are instruments around us, right? They're things in our laboratories. We don't have to explain the data from laboratories before the Big Bang. Okay? So, if you, again, this restriction to a certain space-time structure is only a local restriction. It's not a global restriction. And I think if you start with Bell and you run this way, then David's idea, I want to take the quantum state seriously, so I must take this high-dimensional space seriously, has just evaporated, right? You now understand from very basic methodological principles why configuration space is showing up in your mathematics when you try and represent this thing. Now, why does this look different than classical theory? Why has there been such a problem? Well, because the one thing we really know that's fundamentally different between quantum theory and classical theory is non-locality. Through violations of Bell's inequality. We say, what does quantum theory do that classical dynamics cannot do, or anyway a local classical dynamics cannot do? It's violate Bell's inequality. And that tells us something. Tells us something non-local is going on. Now, by itself, the violations of Bell's inequality doesn't imply that there have to be any non-local beables, right? That's not a theorem. That's not a logical consequence of the violation. Because you could imagine, in principle, if you had local objects like tachyons, I mean, it's a classical picture of tachyons, local objects that happen to go faster than light, and they're sort of producing these violations of Bell's inequality at space-like separation by being traded back and forth between the sides of the experiment, then everything ontologically could be local. And these local things would be superluminal in a very straightforward sense. They would have trajectories through space-time that go outside of light cones. So it's not that violations of Bell's inequality forces us into a non-local beable. However, we don't think that this works like this, right? We don't think, there's no evidence at all, and all kinds of evidence against the idea that violations of Bell inequalities are being produced by passing back and forth local things greater than the speed of light, right? You can't block them, you can't, you know, I mean, all kinds of reasons you would say. We have no theories that work like that, and you can see all kinds of reasons why you wouldn't be able to come up with such a theory. So what do we use? How do we get these violations out of our theory? We have a non-local entity. We have a non-local beable. That's the wave function. That's the quantum state. Now, because we have observable violations of Bell's inequality, for them to be observable, they have to be correlations between controllable and hence local macroscopic conditions on one side and observable and hence macroscopic local conditions on the other side. So there has to be something in my theory that's enforcing correlations between space-like separated local beables. And if we get these objects by coarse-graining the local microscopic beables, and there are no localized messengers like tachyons, then that somehow, that informational connection between the sides must be secured by a non-local entity that governs the global distribution of the local beables in a non-local way. So there has to be some non-local entity, and we've seen why it would be natural to represent it mathematically using a global configuration space. So here's the upshot of all this. How to make a theory after the fashion of Bell. If you follow these suggestions, you at least will get a clear, complete physical theory that makes transparent connections to the data. Right? And it will have three main components. You're going to have a space-time structure that at least around now coarse grains to a familiar four-dimensional form. You'll have a set of postulated physical entities or beables divided into two types, the local and the non-local. And of course, you'll need a dynamics for all of this. Right? You'll need a dynamics for the beables, for the space-time structure itself. If it's not fixed, that's fine. Dividing the beables into local and non-local, we're doing that. We have to divide those because we want the familiar macroscopic objects, as reported in the data, should be made of microscopic local beables. And now, this commentary is to explain a piece of technical terminology as I understand it. Maybe they're local beables that play no role in making familiar macroscopic observable objects, like, I don't know, neutrinos, right? Pointers are not made of neutrinos. You don't see them. So if there's some subset of your local beables that make up observable macroscopic objects, call that subset the primitive ontology of the theory. That's all I would mean by it. Notice this is not a different kind of existence. It's not a different kind of being. It's just noting a certain methodological role that this part of your physical theory is playing in the service of understanding data. So we need some local beables to do that, and on the other hand, we want to implement the non-locality without superluminal entities like local entities like tachyons. Then there's going to be some non-local beables, and there'll be a corresponding division of dynamics, a parallel one. Though there may be a dynamics for the non-local beable, which in this case is the quantum state, and then there'll be another dynamics for the local beables, which ultimately would include the space-time structure itself, if we think of that as dynamical. In Bohm's theory, this division shows up as there being two fundamental equations. Schrödinger's equation for the quantum state and the guidance equation for the local beables. Right? Then you see how everything works. In a GRW-type theory, things work a little differently. You have a kind of GRW dynamics for the quantum state. And then a second equation. I think this is an equation which, when we first met, none of us appreciated so well how important it would be. A second equation that specifies how the quantum state determines some distribution of local beables, which means you have to postulate there are some local beables, right? And it could go differently. So, as it were, all the dynamics, as you'll see in the GRW kind of thing, in a certain sense, in the GRW type of theories, have only really one fundamental dynamical law, because the dynamics of the local beable just piggybacks on the quantum state dynamics via this fixed relation between the quantum state and the local beables. Things work differently in Bohm's theory, of course, because the location of the particles is not a function, can't be determined from the quantum state. All right, so for Bohm-type theories, there's another possibility, a possibility that isn't available for a GRW-type theory. There's a possibility that maybe the universal quantum state, which is really the only one there is, turns out to be static. It doesn't need a dynamics. It's just fixed. And then all the observable changes that constitute the data are generated by the guidance equation. So there, we again could possibly reduce the dynamics to one fundamental dynamics and push, as has been said, the quantum state up into the nomological structure. Or you might, you can sort of see that's in the cards for this type of approach and not in the cards for that type of approach. So, as Bell said, Bohm has shown us a way. Not necessarily the way or the only way, but Bohm has shown us a way. And what I've just tried to do is lay out what I think Bell thought that way was in sufficiently general terms that we can now see, as at least I couldn't many years ago, that a GRW-type theory is of the same form, or can be of the same form. And the marvelous point theory isn't of this form, because you don't get to the data just by coarse-graining the fundamental. But what you get is a clear, complete physical theory where the connection between the physics and the data is absolutely transparent, right? I'm not claiming this is the only way that can be done, but I do think this is this has a very wide scope for variations in terms of which local beables you suggest there are, what non-local beables you suggest there are, what space-time structure you suggest there is, what dynamical laws suggest there are, right? Many of the things we talk about here will fit into the scheme. And I at least think there ought to be the challenge. I don't say everybody has to do it this way. But if you're doing it some other way, if you can't say, yeah, here's how my picture fits into this large scheme, I think we are owed an explanation of the basic architecture of the theory that's as clear and comprehensible as this is. And, you know, if personally, again, it's like Bell said at one point, I guess about theories with, I think this was about theories with no local beables. He said, well, I can't argue there can't be such a theory, but I might, and I'll listen to someone if they come up with it, but I myself will not try to make one, right? So tell me, I'd forgotten.
Some explanation of the non-locality.
Oh, maybe it was super conspiratorial theories. Right. Maybe it was super conspiratorial theories, where he said, well, you know, I can't say it's impossible, and I'll listen to you if you come up with one, but I myself am not going to try and make one. And right now, I guess I feel the same. I'll listen to anybody who says they have a very different way of doing things, but unless I can see as clearly how it works in terms of the connection between the physical picture of the world and the data, as you do in these cases, I would like to understand that as transparently before I'll really take them quite with the same enthusiasm as these many different approaches that we can all be talking about the advantages and disadvantages of. I think that's it.
Oh, actually, it is a comment. You have discussed a lot about, let us call them macro-behaviors and micro-behaviors. Speaking of Bohr and then of Bell and so on and so far, so I would like to point out that in a sense, even Einstein was ready to have only macro-behaviors and not micro-behaviors. In reply to critics, he say, I want macro object to have clear position and location in space and time. I am ready to give up the pretension that something similar happened at the microscopic level. However, and this is the conclusion that something of this sort cannot be done, I think you cannot give up your request of a clear location in space and time at the microscopic level alone, right, saving at the macro level. And the other thing which is strictly related to this is also the position of Bell, because Bell, in the first time in which he presented collapse theory, he has stressed his microbeables, which were the flashes. Yes. But then the last letter, I think, that he wrote in his life to me stresses that what is real in GRW is only the psi function, and it has to be stressed that it lives in 3N-dimensional space or whatever similar you have in quantum field theory. So from this point of view, I think that it is important to take into account that one could be satisfied with the fact that objects have properties at a certain level, and we cannot say something precise.
So, yeah, I wish Bell were here, so I could understand what he meant the second time. There is another case, of course, in the published literature when he says, you have to understand in this theory that you have to take the wave function seriously as something that even though it exists in this high-dimensional space. Now, I've presented a Bell-type approach, if you want to say that, that is moving away from that. Part of what he's saying you can easily understand as just rejecting what are called psi epistemic kind of approaches, where you really take the wave function out of the physics
Absolutely.
Altogether and put it in people's minds, or you just, or make it merely statistical or something. So if he was just, part of it is just expressing being seriously realistic about the quantum state, which we could be happy with if it's a non-local entity and not have to talk about there must then be a high dimensional space in which it lives. I mean, that's what I've been trying to articulate. How Bell understood, as you say, in the original paper, the flash ontology and the way he uses the flashes and says macroscopic objects are galaxies of flashes fits into the picture that I've sketched out here perfectly.
Absolutely.
What he had in mind if later on he said, I don't need those flashes or so on, how to rewrite that paper without it, I honestly couldn't do. So if he had something in mind, or if there's a way. Now, of course, when you say, or what Einstein had in mind, of course, you might think, things at microscopic scale don't have precise positions in the sense as if, suppose you were dealing with a matter density and it's sort of smoothly, you now think that an atom, the sort of matter in an atom sort of smoothly does that. So it's not as if there's a sharp cutoff. And you might say, well, that's going to be good enough at macroscopic scale to give me big lumps of things that are moving around. What I don't understand is how you can take something of which you can say nothing intelligible at microscopic scale in terms of its spatiotemporal location and say putting a lot of them together could give me something at macroscopic scale with a spatiotemporal location. Again, maybe it's just a lack of an imagination on my part, but I don't see how it can be done.
Okay, thanks.
I'd like to go back to the characterization of Bohr. I think you mischaracterized somewhat by presenting the Bohr point of view as being somehow inconsistent. And then you summarized it by saying there was this double ontology, which you implied was therefore inconsistent. I think, and I'm not trying to defend it, but I'm trying to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fairer to say that The only ontology was this classical ontology of what the measurement instruments say, and a renunciation of ontology on the microscopic scale. And just there wasn't any, and I think that's what Bell criticized, and Einstein, et cetera, criticized. It's that you can't ask for more than mathematics on the microscopic scale, and the only kind of real things, predictions, physical things, will be on the macroscopic scale. And doesn't it work fabulously? And it has. I mean, since then, everybody somehow makes it work.
Okay.
So I think the point is that I think he should be criticized not for an inconsistency, but for leaving us unsatisfied by renouncing an ontology on the microscopic scale.
So I think there's just a confusion about the word ontology here. I think that's a lack of communication between us. By an ontology, I just mean whatever the theory postulates to exist. Now, you might say, and what Bohr says often, is that the quantum system is unanschaulich, right? It's not the kind of thing that you can picture to yourself. It's not...
More than picture.
But if it literally did not exist, then I don't see how you could say, gee, the behavior of this macroscopic device, right, it went to the right because it interacted with, or because of the presence in the laboratory of, or because I produced... You couldn't finish that sentence, because if you literally said there is no quantum mechanical ontology, you're just saying it's not part of the physics. And then it couldn't play a role, then there's nothing there to play a role in a physical explanation. That's just what I mean by an ontology. Now, you can pump up the notion on ontology stronger and say, no, by an ontology, I mean not just something that exists, but something that can be described or pictured or something, but then we're just miscommunicating.
No, even, I think, even exists is a word that he would renounce. I think his attitude toward the microscopic scale was, don't ask, don't tell.
But notice, the people who are told don't ask, don't tell actually exist.
I would like to bring the discussion to a very concrete technical level, because that's what we physicists have to do. You were quoting Bell's inequality and its violation by quantum mechanics. This is something that we can understand within non-relativistic quantum mechanics. In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there is no limit to the speed of propagation. So in particular, this whole business with tachyons, and by, you know, sort of alluding to special relativity in discussions of Bell's inequalities and its violation by quantum mechanics, is totally misguided. And it should not be done.
I only mentioned tachyons to say nobody has proposed a serious theory with them, and we shouldn't consider them. That's all I said. The only thing I said about tachyons was, no one has proposed a serious theory that postulates them, and we shouldn't consider them.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with Bell's inequality, because if we accepted that Bell's inequality and its violation in quantum mechanics are statements about non-relativistic quantum theory, then the whole business of tachyons has no place in this discussion.
Again, I only mentioned tachyons to put them aside and say we have no reason to consider them.
Then you should
not
have...
Of course, non-relativistic quantum theory predicts violations... relativistic quantum theory predicts violations of Bell's inequality just as well as non-relativistic.
Absolutely.
Exactly. The only thing... You just weren't listening, Jörg, I'm afraid.
No.
The only thing I said about tachyons was not, this is how we explain things. It was that, in principle, one could have a theory that violated Bell's inequality that postulated things like this. We have no such theory. I see no prospects for such a theory.
No, we have
such a theory. It's not a quantum
theory. We have non-relativistic quantum mechanics. That is a perfect theory for much of what we observe in a laboratory, and it has no limiting propagation speed.
But
and therefore, I would like to humbly ask you to leave out discussions of tachyons in future presentations of this kind.
Even to say we shouldn't consider them?
It is misguided and is misleading.
Even to say it's misguided, which is more or less what I said?
Yeah, but then it's not helpful to describe what, you know, there are lots of misguided things between earth and heaven. Let's not talk about it. Let's talk about the good stuff.
I have a question. I have a question that really is just a question for clarification, and it's not an argument or a discussion.
Good exercise if you tell me why you call tachyons local, at least ontologically. What do you mean by an ontological local, otherwise non-local tachyon?
So you're right. I should never have mentioned it. But for the last time, all I was making was a point of logic, okay? A point of logic. I could imagine a theory. I could make it up out of my head with literally local objects that went faster than light. Local in the normal sense, like particles that went faster than light. So the entire ontology was local in Bell's sense, which could produce violations of Bell's inequality at space-like separation. That's a trivial observation. No such serious theory exists. All I was saying was that the reason why I take non-local entities seriously, the reason why I think there ought to be some non-local beables, was that we have to violate Bell's inequality, and I don't think we're going to do it that way. And so the only thing left is to have a non-local beable rather than a straightforwardly superluminal local beable, which is logically possible. Is that okay for everybody?
Well, actually, my question was a little bit related to what Lajos just said, which is, I'm just asking for a clarification about how the word local is used in this kind of discussion, because it seems to me there are two different meanings. You used it in a way that I actually would have used it myself, to meaning some sort of influence that propagates continuously without jumping over space-time from one space-time region to another. But sometimes it seems like it's used to mean, influence is propagating faster than light outside the light cone,
neither.
Whether or not. So are you using
it? I'm using it in neither of those senses. I'm using it in Bell's sense. So let me say again what it is. A local beable is something that exists in a delimited region of space-time, right? Its existence, as it were, depends only on what's going in a limited region of space-time. So the flashes in the flash ontology, which are just these point-like events, are local beables, because in a given region of space-time, you can just ask, are there any there or not? How many? Where are they?
Yeah,
now, that dynamics is not continuously local in the sense you imagine. The flash ontology is one where there's a flash here and then nothing happens and then a flash here. So it has not the kind, but it is a local, it is clearly a ontologically local sort of thing.
I understand that as an adjective, local beable, that's what you mean.
Yeah.
But people often say that, I thought you said also, that quantum mechanics is non-local in some sense, and therefore it will require either non-local beables or faster than light.
Right, and there
it's that other sense I'm asking about. When
that,
people
that just
say
means
that
it violates Bell's inequality, predicts violations of Bell's inequality, that's all.
That's
which the flash ontology will also give you that prediction and explain it.
I wanted to make